It's Mark Yeager here, wealth architect and lifestyle investor. Let's take your life to the next level. Welcome to the Wealth Architect Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Wealth Architect Podcast. We've got a fun one today. Might be a little bit controversial. I'm kind of excited about that because I like controversy sometimes, especially when it comes to your finances. So who we have on today is a very esteemed guy. I got to talk to him before we started going, and the guy has a wealth of knowledge in the financial business. He's a registered investment advisor, a certified financial planner, and he has a company called Wealth Defense, which I think is a really cool name for a company. And we're going to talk about some really cool things, and we're going to try to open your mind to different ways of investing. We're not going to give you any investing advice because this is a show about education and information, but we are going to kind of open your mind to some of the things that are out there. That's what we do here on the Wealth Architect Podcast. Hopefully you've been picking that up, but now we've got an expert to help us do it as well. So please help me welcome Barry Rutten to the show. Barry, welcome.
Mark, I'm really excited to be here. This is going to be fun. I can tell.
Let's have a little fun. Tell me a little bit about your business, maybe your backstory, that kind of thing. We'll just jump right into it right after that.
Yeah, you know, I've listened to a lot of podcasts, and every time the host asks the guest, tell me about your background, I'm like, oh, I hope this is really short. So I'm going to keep mine really short. Yeah. I started out in law school because two things. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, and I had a big mouth. Everybody said you should go to law school. I didn't stay with it. It really wasn't a fit for me. And I went across the street. I was at the University of San Diego School of Law. And I went across the street to the undergraduate library, went in the basement, and they had all the shelves of all the different professional journals of like every industry. And I just started walking and flipping and reading. And I came across the Journal of Financial Planning. And I started looking at a few issues and I went, huh, clients without the negativity of like civil and criminal law. Although if I had known that there was things like entertainment and sports law at the time, I might've stuck with it, right? I could be representing Hollywood stars and hanging out with those people. But so the reason I tell it that way is because I went into this as a profession. You know, I saw myself on a professional path. I just changed professional path. So I've always treated this as a profession in terms of my own education, how I approach clients. And I've really kind of almost thought it as similar to a doctor without all the blood and guts and you know, really follow that, you know, examination, diagnosis, prescription model. And a lot of people kind of start with the prescription. And I think that's really a bad idea. And so, you know, first do no harm, right?
Yeah.
And so what I've done over the course of my career is try to, I guess, chart my own course. You know, I see and read what everybody does, and some of it's good, but a lot of it's not. And so I think I've developed a set of beliefs that I share, and try to do the best job I possibly can in helping people make good decisions for themselves. You know, I don't want to just say, do this, trust me. I want people to understand why they're doing it and why it'll help them avoid financial loss or achieve financial success. So they can, you know, if I fall overboard, you know, I'm a boater. Anybody who knows me, I'm a boater. So I use a lot of boating analogies. You know, if I fall overboard or I have a heart attack, I still want my wife to be able to pilot the boat and get us back to a dock. So I'm, you know, always saying, hey, take over the helm and, you know, make sure she remembers how to do different things. And I've had fellow boaters who their wives don't know how to turn the key in the ignition on the boat or shut the key off and everything in between. And I think that's really dangerous.
Yeah, it is. I had a person on a few weeks back, and she was basically an advisor for widows.
Yeah.
There's such a niche there that people, you know, who are left behind, it's widowers too, but she's primarily after women and helps women. And they just don't have a clue. Like they've never been given the keys to the boat. So, so what ends up happening is those people kind of turn to Cramer as their financial guru, right? And screaming. I know you love Cramer.
Well, I think of him, you know, I you know, this is recorded, so I'm going to be very careful. I'm not going to disparage anyone.
well, but that's a start right there.
I think of him like the way I think of the weatherman or the weatherwoman. If they would just have to get on the next day and say,
yeah,
I was wrong, that's 4,875 times I've been wrong since I've been on this channel.
Yep.
I just want Kramer to be able to say, okay, here's my big pronouncement I made 6 weeks ago, and I was breathtakingly wrong. Now here's another thing I'm going to try and get you to do. I just want them to be honest about these prognostications and say, you know, I was wrong.
Well, they did a study. They did a study of what he says to, you know, buy, or, you know, sell or whatever. And I think it came out to like, he's wrong 71% of the time. Now, of course, that's a study that you can go back and find. You can, you know, if you're in a stock long enough, you're going to have a pullback or you're going to have an increase. So I don't know how valid the study is, but there is somebody that created an ETF that goes against what he says.
The contrarian Kramer ETF. Right?
That's so funny.
Yeah, he's got I guess if you're a baseball player, he's got an okay average, right?
Yeah, right.
But, you know, 7 out of 10, you know, so, you know, I think it all fits into my philosophy about the financial media overall, if I could kind of take that path a little bit longer.
Let's talk about that, yeah.
You know, I can't tell you the number of times, you know, when I used to commute. I don't commute anymore, but I'd be listening to Drive Time Radio, and then...
Yeah.
There are these well-known hosts, and again, I don't want anybody's lawyer contacting me, but I think people know who the really popular financial hosts are on Drive Time Radio, on TV. And, you know, a lot of times I hear them speak, and I almost drive off the road because I'm yelling at the radio, because somebody calls in who's a real living, breathing person with a life and a history and facts and feelings and a family and objectives, and the producer has screened them for one of two things: either something controversial or that they know is going to get the host riled up, because that makes good radio or that makes good TV.
Sure.
Or the question the person has is going to allow the host to continue to reinforce their common themes and common messages about the enemies that they feel are the ones they really have to go after. And what stuns me is the people get to speak for about 30 seconds. And it's really just like the host is almost like, great, stop talking, because they've already seen what the issue is on their little prompter. Their producer has already typed it in and they're seeing it on a screen.
Sure.
It just looks like they're listening to the other person. And then they do their screed, right? They say their thing. And what you have to remember is that television, radio, even the print media, but especially television or radio, the idea is not to really solve anybody's problem. That's not their job. In fact, most of these folks, if not any of them, are like myself, a highly regulated professional, the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, who issues the Certified Financial Planner designation, highly regulated, fiduciary responsibilities. Same with the SEC's requirements, the Securities and Exchange Commission's requirements around, I'm an investment advisor representative of a registered investment advisory firm. Very highly regulated. These people have no restrictions at all. They can say anything they want with no consequences to it.
Yep.
And what I feel is just really inappropriate is what they're really trying to do is sell commercial time. What they're trying to do is keep you tuned to the radio or tuned to the TV program past the commercials that pay their salaries.
Yeah.
So they need to be controversial enough for you to go, I'm not going to tune over here to, you know, a music station. I'm going to listen for the next person he grills or the next enemy he fillets. I guess those are, I must be hungry. I'm giving you food analogies.
I thought you were going to stick to boat analogies.
Right. The next person they have walk the plank. Right. So I feel that the 30 second drive time financial host kind of thing is not only not a good place to get advice, but I think it makes people think that that's how they that's the amount of time they should devote to their big financial decisions. And they tend to approach it much like, God, this is going to be another food analogy, Baskin Robbins, right? They walk in and they're presented with these cases that have, you know, 31 flavors. And it would be like asking the person behind the counter, what's good? Well, you know, if you don't like mint chocolate chip ice cream and that person does, well, their opinion's irrelevant.
Yeah.
Right. I personally think, and I know I'm going to offend some people here, I think mint chocolate chip ice cream is like eating chocolate with toothpaste on it. I don't care for it. Okay. But my wife loves it.
Right.
Right. So, So we need to make sure that anything we do is actually a really good fit for the person it's designated for, which takes more time, more questions, more insights, get the facts, get the feelings, get the history, help people self-discover what they really want instead of just going, boop, here's your piece of advice, next.
Well, you know, I totally agree there. And to me, it kind of goes back to a pet peeve that I have, and that is that we don't teach people about finances in our school system. I think it's on purpose to keep people dumbed down. We know, I would say this on my podcast here, that we know more about Romeo and Juliet and Copernicus and King Tut than we know about, you know, buying a house, buying a car, investing in the stock market, any of these things that we use every day. We don't use Romeo and Juliet or the Pythagorean theorem every day, but we sure do use, our financial stuff every day. And it does make a difference when you can empower somebody to be a driver or a co-driver in the seat of their financial, their financial life. So I totally agree with that. Now let's think
about the home economics class, right?
Yeah.
You know, when I was in school, it was, you know, how to cook and sew and things like that. But an economics class today, if they would address a few basic things about just credit,
supply and demand,
and avoiding that, and compound interest, and, you know, just simple things, turning assets into income, which I know you totally support. You know, what's painful for me, Mark, is that, you know, let's just be really direct here. There's sort of lower income people, middle income people, high income people. And I'm not judging any of those three groups as either good or bad. But what you often see behaviorally is that low income people buy stuff.
Yes.
They buy things. And I think to some degree, and I'm not trying to be a psychologist here, I think to some degree there's a kind of a salve, an emotional salve of that momentary, oh, I got a new iPhone 37. And, you know, I feel good about that for about 12 seconds. And then Apple comes out with another one.
On to the next.
I think the middle income folks with a little bit more money, they tend to take on a lot of liabilities, right? They commit a lot of their income to monthly payments for things like cars and mortgages and other debts. When's the last time you've actually seen the price of a car in a car ad? It's always been monthly for decades.
Yes.
It was changed. It used to be a car ad. If you go back into look at magazines, car ads were, you know, your car is $8,950. Now this is your monthly payment.
Yep.
Everything is now dedicated to supporting these liabilities they take on. The wealthy tend to convert income into assets, and especially cash flowing assets. And I think that if that one lesson was taught in school somewhere,
yeah,
high school, college, it should almost be a requirement of graduating from college that you're taught, okay, now you're going to go out and get a job. This is what a dollar can do. And, you know, if you just have that dollar do one thing once, buy a pair of sneakers, you're done.
Yep.
But if you can have that dollar turn into $3 and that dollar can pay you, that's how you convert labor into wealth. And that's financial independence, right? You have enough assets generating enough cash flow to live the lifestyle that you want. And it's just, to me, it's completely unfair or unjust that one basic premise is not taught to people. And therefore we have too much of the society struggling, or anytime there's a blip, they're wiped out. You know, yeah. When we last had, you know, 2008, 2009 recession, 2020 with the pandemic, you had people literally go bankrupt and lose their home or get, you know, evicted or foreclosed on, had their car repossessed within 90 days, boom, done. That's terrible. That just, you know, and it's just such a basic premise. I'm sure you have folks on who sometimes talk about very advanced topics. I know you have a high level of sophistication yourself, but, you know, God, let's at least get the basics right. So that we don't have these big calamities every time there's a wrinkle, and we both know there's another wrinkle coming, right? There's another wrinkle coming down the road here pretty soon if it hasn't already arrived.
Right. So let's talk about a couple things. So I want to get to the process of helping people, but I'd like to start out with a lightning round, and I'm just creating this right now on the fly.
Uh-oh.
I'm just going to ask you a couple of questions, and I want to have a quick answer about what you think about it, and that'll kind of give me a flavor of if we can go a little bit deeper on that. So,
okay,
and this is the framing around this is, Wall Street BS. Okay. Because I'm from Wall Street. You're a financial guy. You've got some Wall Street experience. And I think you and I both would agree. I don't know yet, but we might agree that, you know, a lot of the stuff on Wall Street is, it's not really the best advice. It's just, they're just kind of guidelines that keeps people within the rails, but I don't know if it's the best advice. So, all right, you ready?
Ready.
All right. Diversification.
Great theory. The world's become hyper interconnected and it hasn't really panned out. You know, it'd be nice to think that I have a bunch of different asset classes that are not correlated. They don't move together at the same time, but through the last several, you know, big economic calamities, including right now, you have all these different asset classes, you know, stocks, bonds, whatever, all down at the same time. You know, you think, where do I put my, money? Now there's things that allow you to kind of step off the roller coaster when things go bad, meaning there's vehicles that allow you to capture the upside and not deal with the downside. But as far as just pure, you know, sort of that, you know, Chicago, there's University of Chicago economics is where all the Nobel Prize winning theories about asset allocation, diversification came from. But you just don't see it play out because the world has become very, and going back to Wall Street, the traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S, not traitors, but sometimes I feel like they're traitors. you know, when the news media says investors today did X, I call BS on that. Investors didn't do anything. They got up, went to work, did their job, came home, fed their kids. What traders did is used high-speed computer programs and algorithms to try and capture
pennies,
motion or create motion to make profit on movement. Well, when you're moving, you know, $1 billion and there's a 12-cent difference in the price between one thing and another, that's called arbitrage.
Yep.
They just made a ton of money, produced nothing, did nothing. And yet, you know, yesterday company X that makes, you know, billions of dollars was worth this number. And today they're worth this lower number because a bunch of computer programs said, let's sell this stuff because there's a way to capture some money. So that's, I think, what I just wish, again, the news media would have to say, regular investors today did absolutely nothing, but were screwed by all the traders on Wall Street who decided to make a couple extra $1 million today. Now let's go to the weather and sports.
That would be so, so honest. All right. And a pet peeve of mine is, you know, I'll get on CNBC in the morning. I'll check it out. Dow futures down as investors digest Hong Kong reaction to China's decline. Like, right. How do you connect that? Like, it's not why the futures are down. It's down because more sellers than buyers, right? Supply and demand. All right. Right. Next one. Just buy a nice portfolio of stocks, bonds, and ETFs, and you'll be fine.
You know, I do subscribe to the idea that time is the biggest factor in both, you know, compound interest success and also smoothing out the bumps in the road, right? So if you look at, you know, investing from, say, the Great Depression time, you know, the 30s, 29-30, till now, and if you look at that and you try and plot that on a graph, in our industry, we call that a mountain chart, right? It kind of shows the roller coaster squiggly lines, and they're not actually real smooth curves like a roller coaster. They're spikes up and down. If you plot that on a piece of paper, they have to use what's called a logarithmic scale. If you look real close at that chart, you're going to see all of these different economic events, all these big scary things that in the moment were terrifying, caused people to run and hide in a bunker.
Sure.
But then, you know, right after that, you saw a big thing, you know, go up, and over time, that mountain chart goes up. It doesn't, you know, just plummet to zero. I think people need to understand two things. One, the markets can't go straight up. They can't. It doesn't work that way. They go up and they pull back and they go up and pull back. Some of it's, I think, a little speculative and not a good idea. But if you took a string and you pushed a string together over a short period of time, the string would, you know, be up and down, up and down, up and down. Mm-hmm. If you take the ends of the string and pull them straight, the line is smoother. So the longer the time period, so 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, the safer things become.
So can I challenge you? Can I challenge you on that?
Yeah, yeah.
I want to be respectful to my guests.
No. Challenge away.
You may totally agree. You may totally disagree. But if you plot the dollar value from 1930 to today, it will basically go from all the way in the upper left, all the way down to not to a lose a loss of 99.5%. So if you take that chart and you flip it, it'll probably be the same chart as the one you just put up on, with the skyscraper, right? So are we getting the return, the real returns that would outpace the amount of dollar decline, product, the ability to buy something, right? The amount of inflation, really. The deflation of the dollar, the inflation of goods and services, or are they the same? I mean, you're basically keeping up with inflation if you put money in like that. What do you think?
Well, I think you've really hit on the fundamental issue, and unfortunately, they have been uncoupled in our society.
Yeah.
Think about this: if you could earn, pick a number, 8%, zero risk, would you ever invest in anything that had all the volatility of the stock market? Absolutely not.
No way.
So why do people invest in things like the stock market? It's because they're trying to stay ahead of inflation. There's only one answer. They're trying to stay ahead of inflation. So you can look at the sort of absolute return, this thing went up X percent this year, but what happened to the cost of everything you need to buy if you were using that money to, buy things? It's why in retirement, I don't believe in liquidating assets to pay your electric bill,
right?
I think you park some money in cash, and then with a proper plan, you replenish that cash and you push assets out 10, 15 years to replenish the replenishers, if you will, because things are going to get more expensive. And we have to address what you were referring to, which is the real return, which is return minus, if you want to call it decline in dollar or decline in purchasing power or inflation, they're all kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, that chart, I that would be an interesting thing, right? Could, if you reverse the plot, the purchasing power of a dollar has plummeted over time, right? And so, you look at what a stamp cost or milk, you've seen these things. What did stamps cost? What did milk cost? What did bread cost?
Yep.
What did a car cost? My parents bought a house that was similar to my first house for $17,000 in the 60s. Well,
yeah,
that house probably sells for $1 million now. And so what we're really trying to do is fight a very vicious, relentless enemy. Albert Einstein talked about the eighth wonder of the world being compound interest.
Yeah.
Well, its evil cousin, its evil twin is inflation.
Yeah.
And purchasing power erosion. And we have to address those. The challenge is when we address those, we tend to end up in what are perceived as riskier assets. And so more and more the financial industry has responded with tools that buffer some of this absolute brutal up and down roller coaster, and some of them try and snip off the very tops and very bottoms and keep you in a narrower range. Some of them try and keep you completely out of the bottom and only the top, and there's some trade-offs for that. I think that's really our biggest challenge is to not have people lose money.
Yeah,
because it takes a lot of time and a lot of rate of return to recover from the negatives. Mathematically, it takes more return than the percentage of the loss.
Yes.
And that's the thing, because we don't have 600-year lifespans. We have limited lifespans. We can't go through too many of these big drops where it takes these huge returns cumulatively to come back to just zero before we even go ahead. So we really got to do a lot of risk management or risk mitigation. That's really I think one of the most important things that people miss in their investing is, or just their strategy is what's your downside protection?
Yeah.
You're from the super high end, of the investing world. We know that pension funds that manage billions of dollars, college endowments, billions of dollars, they all create, what are called investment policy statements, which essentially says, I'm targeting this rate of return. I'm willing to accept this much variability called standard deviation. And I'm willing to take this much risk to do it. And if you don't do that, I'm going to move my billions of dollars to another manager.
Yes.
If the regular investor would have some set of parameters like that, and I'll do that with clients and say, hey, what can we live with? What we cannot live with? What do we need? What do we have to have? What can we not have? What do we not have to have?
Yeah.
So if your personal investing rate doesn't need to be 9%, don't expose yourself to the risk that comes with 9%. You know, you can be in a little bit narrower box. So I think that's the really big problem, is that individual investors don't tend to operate the way professional investors do.
And I think investing, correct me if you don't agree, but investing comes down to mindset, right? I tell my investors, and I have a program called the Cash Flow Machine. So I'm a big believer in cash flow like you. And I teach them the first thing, look, 90% of investing is mindset, but mindset comes from having a set of rules, and the rules help you mitigate your emotions, because the emotions are the enemy of the trader or the investor. And so it all comes down to that mindset piece and the rules piece. So what do you think about, you know, if people have a set of rules, are they able to, you know, wade through the water a little bit easier than just kind of listening to Cramer?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you're preaching to the choir for me, but I think for your listeners, I think you really need to hear what Mark just said. You have to operate with a set of rules and a plan. And if the rules and the plan haven't changed or don't need to change, then don't change anything.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, people tend to act and react based on emotion, not based on a set of rules. And that's why they get whipsawed. We've all heard the famous thing where, you know, the market, we'll call it the stock market, it supposedly has done 10% with dividends reinvested and all this over time. But the average investor has done 3 or 4. Why? Because they put their money in and out, right? And if you miss these, you know, 10 or 40 best trading days, you give up huge amounts of return. You just never know when that's going to happen.
Right.
So, you know, the idea is staying invested. But I think you're right. I think it's, you know, we are emotional creatures. Yep. And, you know, that's why sometimes you hear the advice of, you know, don't open your mail.
Hey, it's Mark Yeager here to tell you about our Cash Flow Machine trading program that's designed to teach you how to make safe, reliable income. Now, we shoot for 2 to 4% a month of income and growth in your portfolio. And we have courses to teach you how to do this yourself or inside a mastermind community. And the best part of that is it only takes about 20 minutes a week to implement. Now, while 2 to 4% a month doesn't sound like much, I show you exactly how we took my IRA from $111,000 to over $500,000 in just 19 months without huge risk. I'm not telling you this to brag, just to show you that you could do this too. So to learn more about this program, go to cashflowmachine.io. That's cashflowmachine.io, and you can learn more.
You know, I once had that's a great story. I once had a woman who came to me with literally a fistful of Coca-Cola stock certificates.
Oh, wow. I've had those.
Actual real paper stock certificates.
Yeah.
That she had, I think, gotten from her grandfather.
Wow.
And she took the number, you know, back then, you know, the shares, you know, here's 100 shares in this certificate. So she had, you know, I don't know how many shares, you know, say several thousand in all these certificates.
Pre-split.
And she just multiplied those numbers, the number of shares she thought she owned, times the current share price of Coca-Cola. And she thought she had, you know, $80,000 or something. And I said, well, no, that's actually not what's happened. And we talked about stock splits and blah, 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 blah. And she was a multimillionaire and didn't know it.
Oh, right? My God.
And that's like my best story of, like, she just had these things in a safe deposit box, and Coca-Cola sold lots of sugary syrup to, you know, people in cans and people at movie theaters, and she didn't know anything about going on, and they just ran their business, and she became a multimillionaire because she just didn't get rid of the certificates.
Wow.
I think that the other thing that people don't realize is how important in your investing cash flow actually is. I want to get paid. I want to either get paid interest if I'm a lender, or I want to get paid dividends if I'm an owner, right? If I buy stock. And the reinvestment of dividends is critical to achieving the kinds of returns people seek and desire. And if you think about it, if I'm trying to hit, I'll say 7%, and I get a dividend of 3%, that means my investment only has to grow 4%. Much easier to do.
Yeah, sure.
Something that's just like, you know, some small cap thing that has to grow 8%, which means it makes it much more volatile. So I really believe in cash flow, because you can't fake cash flow, right? If you go back to Enron, right? all these earnings and all the, it was all smoke and mirrors, right?
Yeah.
If you pay a dividend, right, that is a share of the income of the operation of the business, of the profits shared with the shareholders. Can't fake a check. It's real money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you often see people gravitate, especially in times of economic turmoil, to companies that pay dividends because they're more resilient. Yeah. They're real substantial operating businesses that, you know, sometimes they may have to adjust that dividend or whatever, but I think it's the fundamental attractiveness of owning stocks. And that is, I get to buy into a bunch of businesses, some of which I understand what they do, some of which I don't understand what they do. And those are in this country and other countries. And all those people are getting up every day trying to make money. And I get a piece of that. I think we've lost some of that fundamentalism as we chase the next sexy thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, everybody talks about Warren Buffett. Well, Warren Buffett predominantly owns things that you can explain to an eighth grader.
Yes, he does.
And you know, I think that is also lost in the.
And he also professes what you said a few minutes ago, and that's don't lose money, right? If you can figure out a way to not lose money, that's the best thing. All right, so let me. I could talk to you for probably 5 hours about financial stuff and still not and run out of things to talk about. So let me just summarize kind of what our discussion has been today. Let's go from the back forward. Cash flow is very, very important. Compound interest is also very important. So whether you're cash flowing into compound interest vehicles so that it grows faster than the rate of inflation, which is another topic, then that's really important. You got to stay ahead of that rate of inflation. And then third, mindset is critical. I'm paraphrasing it the way I say it. Probably yeah. Having rules and maybe a process and procedure of how to invest is really important. Would you agree? That's a pretty good summary of what we got.
Yeah. And I think if you can't, you know, we all, you know, surgeons don't operate on themselves.
Right.
So they could be extremely knowledgeable, know everything about their body, all the organs, where the organs are located, what blood vessels are connected to it. But you don't take out a mirror and start cutting into yourself.
Right.
I think it's important to be knowledgeable. If you feel 100% comfortable kind of doing it on your own and you're doing the research and you really understand what you're doing and you've set out a set of rules and parameters, then you should do that. If yeah. you don't, you should seek some advice. Make sure that advice is of a fiduciary nature, has your sole best interest at its very heart. Be a little bit critical, be a little bit skeptical, and make sure it feels right. And make sure people are asking you the right questions about how you react and how you feel and your history and your give you some hypotheticals. Because if you don't, and you don't have that set of rules and parameters, you really are going to be, you know, kind of whipsawed around and jump from one thing to another. And that's where people really, really struggle.
The catchphrase on our podcast is never give up your power and your health, your wealth, or your time. And that doesn't mean don't hire people that know what they're doing. It just means don't be powerless. Don't be going in and just saying, here's my stock certificates, figure out what to do. And, you know,
right.
I'll come back in 10 years and see how you did. It's take an active role in being the co-pilot or the pilot of your ship, to go back to your boat.
It should be collaborative, right? You should collaborate with your doctor, collaborate with your accountant, collaborate with your lawyer, collaborate yeah. with your financial advisor. They're collaborations. They're not abdications. That's my phrase.
Yeah.
Collaborations, not abdications.
Right. All right. So let's transition now to what kind of advice could you give people about, I know we're not going to give specific advice, but what kind of advice would you give people that are listening that may not have their feet on the ground with their finances just yet, or maybe want to make a shift? What would you give them about the process of what to do next, process of investing?
Well, I think it's important to have some fundamentals. If you could think of I'm going to keep this really, really simple. If you think of a pyramid, a triangle, the base layer, the biggest layer should be savings. You need to have a really substantial cash cushion for emergencies and opportunities, right?
Yes.
The next layer should be protection. You need to transfer risk where it makes sense to transfer risk. So, for example, if you are a breadwinner, an income earner in a family, and your family relies upon that income, you need life insurance because the only thing that can replace, you know, millions of dollars of future cumulative income with the snap of a finger. If you have a home that's worth, you know, $500,000 or $750,000 or $1 million and it burns to the ground, if you don't have $1 million sitting somewhere to rebuild your house, your whole financial world just changed radically, right? Yes. So what we're trying to do is prevent financial motion backwards. We're trying to avoid financial loss. And then finally, the top of the period is investing. And that is in whatever form makes sense. I'm not talking about which things you should invest in, but you should really focus on the accumulation of assets that will produce income. That could be real estate, it could be stocks, it could be bonds.
Sure.
You want to be paid, right? Instead of you always paying everybody else, put your money in a position where other people are paying you. And that can get very, very creative. There's a big universe out there. But I also think that if you skip the fundamentals, right? I've had people just, you know, want to go right to investing. And I'm like, well, first, their job is to keep you from going backwards. Put a financial brick wall behind you. Once we've done that, then we don't have to worry about that stuff. Then we can move forward. But we got to keep moving that brick wall behind you. As you make financial progress, we've got to keep moving the wall behind you, or else we've created a new gap, right? So if I'm in 2022, I don't want to go back to 2012. But if I'm in 2032, I don't want to go back to 2022. So I always got to make sure my defensive position stays, you know, tracking with me.
Right.
So that I never have a big slip back.
Yes.
You know, a little blip is okay, but not a big, you know, you want to give back 20 years of wealth. That's crazy.
Where can people go to find you and, you know, get a little bit of more of Barry Rutten?
Website's really easy. WealthDefenseGroup.com. WealthDefenseGroup.com. You know, you touched on the name. You know, the way I think about it is, you know, your financial castle, right?
Yeah.
And if you think about castles, they were really smart back then. They did a couple of things. They put them on high ground, right? Because it's really hard to fight uphill. They call that being in an unassailable position.
Yeah.
And assail is the word like for attack. So you want to kind of have your financial life on high ground that's unassailable, can't be attacked by the teeming hordes. You want to put a moat around your money. That's kind of our catchphrase. They dug a really wide channel that people couldn't really swim across. And if they did, they put alligators in the pond. And the only way across was with a little drawbridge, right? And if they pulled the drawbridge up, it was, again, much harder to have to wade across the water to then get against the walls of the castle so they could shoot arrows down you and pour hot oil on you and
right. Other
lovely things that they did back then. So wealth defense means as you're accumulating assets and wealth, protect what you've got, right? Turn that labor, turn that income into income producing assets, and don't go backwards. And then use smart tools to stop suffering these giant, you know, wealth destroying backsteps that everybody seems to think are inevitable and required, and they're not.
Yeah.
So wealthdefensegroup.com. And I really hope folks notice that if they go to that website, there's no products there. It's all concept. We need to start with what are you trying to accomplish and who are you as a unique individual? And once we know that, developing an actual plan and a specific set of rules and parameters to attain that plan, that's actually fairly easy. It's when we start figuring out, you know, which ice cream is good at Baskin Robbins that we get in trouble.
Yeah. This is Barry Rutten, certified financial planner. And if you want some advice on being solid and putting together a really good program, this is probably your guy. At least it's worth it to explore it, and go to wealthdefensegroup.com to find out a bit more about Barry. Barry, thank you so much for being on the Wealth Architect podcast. Really appreciate
thank you
being here.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Really enjoyed it.
Remember, everybody, never give up your power in your health, your wealth, or your time. See you next time on the Wealth Architect podcast. Take care.
You've been listening to the Wealth Architect podcast with Mark Yeagy. Follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Like and subscribe on YouTube. Share and tell your friends. See you soon.